Hello there and welcome. Today is Tuesday, Wednesday, February 5th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the State of the Union is strong. That's the word from the President in his speech to Congress.
In just 3 short years, we have shattered the mentality of American decline.
A tumultuous beginning for Democrats working to deny the president a second term. Also ahead, Chinese Americans. Concerns about being profiled due to the coronavirus. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. President Donald Trump Tuesday evening making his case in the annual State of the Union speech, telling the American people that the country has achieved the Great American Comeback. The speech comes after the president became the third in the nation's history to be impeached, and as his trial is still underway, but he looked to make the case that despite the division, the country's better off now than 4 years ago, and that he has kept his election promises, as he also makes a pitch to voters in an election year. The speech began with Republicans chanting 4 more years before touting what he presented as a thriving America that was not respected before he took office.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Madam Speaker, Mr. Vice President, members of Congress, the First Lady of the United States, and my fellow citizens, 3 years ago, we launched the Great American Comeback. Tonight, I stand before you to share the incredible results. Jobs are booming. Incomes are soaring. Poverty is plummeting. Crime is falling. Confidence is surging. And our country is thriving and highly respected again.
Well, he also talked about a booming economy, taking a not-so-subtle swipe at his predecessor, President Barack Obama.
America's fortunes are on the rise, and America's future is blazing bright. The years of economic decay are over. The days of our country being used, taken advantage of, and even scorned by other nations are long behind us.
And after a long, drawn-out trade war, the president spoke of a preliminary agreement on trade with China.
Days ago, we signed the groundbreaking new agreement with China that will defend our workers, protect our intellectual property, bring billions and billions of dollars into our treasury, and open vast new markets for products made and grown right here in the USA.
And the president addressed social issues, speaking of how he is bringing people of all races together.
We are advancing with unbridled optimism and lifting our citizens of every race, color, religion, and creed very, very high.
And in an unusual move, he awarded the highest civilian honor in the middle of the speech to controversial talk show host Rush Limbaugh, who had just announced he has late-stage lung cancer and was an invited guest of the president sitting next to the First Lady. And as we speak now, Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer is delivering the Democratic response to President Trump's State of the Union address, saying that Republicans are not helping the average Americans by improving health care or helping them get by financially. Joining us to talk more about the State of the Union, the president's address, joining us live is Jennifer Victor. She is a an associate professor of political science at George Mason University's Schar School of Policy and Government. Thank you so much for being with us. It was a long speech, and I know it's taking some time to gather it all. Pretty unusual, but thank you for being with us.
Happy to be here.
What struck you about this the most? It certainly seemed like not the usual State of the Union speech.
Yeah, there were a number of unusual moments. In some ways, there were parts of it that were very similar to previous State of the Unions that Trump has given, where it's a very crafted and scripted speech and he sticks to the teleprompter. And quite unusually for him, it's sort of a poised and polished speech, which I think is not his preferred manner of trying to connect with an audience. But in the past, particularly at things like State of the Union, he's done them adequately. And we saw some of that tonight as well, some of that same kind of, you know, be presidential, read the teleprompter, give the speech. But at the same time, there were also a number of what I might call sort of violations of traditions or norms. He appeared to refuse to shake the Speaker of the House's hand before he began speaking when he arrived at the dais. He openly praised his appointees to the Supreme Court in a politically tinged way that we don't usually see from presidents during the State of the Union. And the various, it's become habitual for presidents to include audience members or special guests in the gallery to recognize in a pointed way that often is a little bit blatantly kind of pandering. But there was quite a bit more of that type of thing in this address than we've seen in the past, and it gave the event a much more of a, some people on Twitter are calling it sort of a game show feel or much more of a almost a campaign event type feel than what you typically see in the State of the Union.
It was also unusual, I thought, to continue. We know that this president does like to go after his predecessor, Barack Obama, but there were a number of references to his predecessor. This is after 3 years into his own presidency.
Right. Well, sometimes in competitive sport of any kind, including politics, it helps to have an opponent. And at the moment, the Democrats are trying to figure out who exactly their opponent is. In the absence of having a specific opponent on the other side for him to attack, it makes just as much sense to go after the previous occupier of the office from the other party.
Did he lay out a picture that is accurate as to what is happening to our union?
Over the next hours and days, I'm sure there'll be a number of articles that come out with fact checks of the speech. My sort of quick fact check that I was trying to do on the fly did note a number of sort of misstatements or exaggerations or he has some kind of unusual ways of pointing to things and exaggerating about accomplishments in ways that don't need to be. And I can't remember now exactly which point of the speech was, but he was saying there was some sort of statistic that was the highest, and then he said the highest ever. And I forget exactly now what the statistic was, but it is something that has become that is at a high point in his administration, but it's not the high point of all time. And so it sort of adds a level of exaggeration to some of his claims that just aren't necessary in a way. Like there would be ways to sort of brag about what you've done without going to the point of getting to the extreme where people might accuse you of lying about it.
Right, the biggest ever, the best of all time, the greatest of
exactly,
this or that.
All of the platitudes.
Right, he really feels the need to say that often. And the predecessor comments, obviously, we talked about that. And what do you think the overall motive, what was he trying to achieve in the State of the Union? Because it was unusual. It didn't feel as though he was trying to bring both parties together.
Well, frankly, it was a campaign event. I mean, it wasn't the type of campaign event where he goes and throws a rally and, riles a crowd up for a couple of hours. It was a polished campaign event. Like, if you want a preview of what 2020 is going to be like over the next 9 months on our way to the November election, or I probably did that math wrong, this is what it's going to be like. It's going to be pulling out all of the red meat for the Republican Party, and Democrats standing up and claiming that those things are false, and figuring out how to respond in a political environment where the traditions and norms that the culture usually follows are no longer in place, which can make it a challenging environment in which for a political opposition to combat in.
Right. As we heard, you know, the president didn't, as you said, the president didn't shake Nancy Pelosi's hand, and it didn't seem like there were any olive branches coming out. And campaign speech.
Yeah, the only ones that I heard that got real bipartisan support, except for, you know, some of the sort of game show stuff, was the a line about paid family leave and a line about infrastructure. So there were two points of actual policy that were a little bit more traditional State of the Union stuff appeared to be points where perhaps Republicans and Democrats could come together on some legislation.
All right. Well, we really appreciate you coming on and giving us some perspective. This is Jennifer Victor, Associate Professor of Political Science at George Mason University's Schar School of Policy and Government. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer has been delivering the Democratic response to President Trump's State of the Union address, saying that Republicans are not helping average Americans improve their health care. But she started the speech by saying she would focus on what her party is doing and not what the president is saying. Quote, she said, instead of talking about what he's saying, I'm going to highlight what Democrats are doing. After all, you can listen to what someone says, but to know the truth, watch what they do. Well, before members gathered to hear President Trump's address Tuesday, senators had the chance to give speeches on the floor of their chamber explaining why they stand on the president's impeachment trial, where they stand on the president's impeachment. The speeches are not officially part of the trial itself and unlikely to make much of a difference, and the senators expected acquittal of Trump when they cast a final vote later today. House Democrats prosecuting the impeachment case against Trump and his defense team both offered forceful closing arguments after 2 weeks of trial proceedings. Congressman Adam Schiff, the lead House manager prosecuting Trump, passionately implored the 100 members of the Senate acting as jurors to do impartial justice, or the president will be emboldened to feel he is above the law.
You can't trust this president to do the right thing, not for 1 minute, not for one election, not for the sake of our country.
But White House counsel Jay Sekulow told senators there's no evidence that Trump did anything wrong, and that rather than ousting Trump from office, the only solution was to leave it to the voters to decide his fate.
These articles fail on their face as they do not meet the constitutional standard for impeachable offenses. No amount of testimony could change that fact.
The House impeached Trump in December for allegedly abusing his power and obstructing Congress. The Constitution allows Congress to remove a president from office for committing high crimes and misdemeanors. Joining us to further understand the process, VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson is joining us from Capitol Hill. Catherine, why do they hold closing arguments on Monday when they're not voting until later today on whether to remove or acquit the president?
So as eager as the senators were to wrap up this trial after 2.5 weeks of sitting in their seats silent, they did want a chance to make their thoughts about impeachment known, because, of course, remember that they have not been allowed to speak up until now except through those written questions that they submitted during the Q&A portion of the impeachment trial. This week is giving them an opportunity to do what senators do best, which is to get on the Senate floor, get in front of the TV cameras, reach out to their constituents and voters, and really thoughtfully work through the reason why they're either voting to acquit President Trump or voting to remove him from office. And part of what's going on here is the fact that it's an election year and a third of the U.S. Senate is up for re-election. So what they're really doing is justifying possibly the most important political decision of their careers to the voters who will be looking at them this November and deciding if they should send them back to Washington and back to the U.S. Senate.
Isn't it all a foregone conclusion, though? We haven't heard of any Republicans ready to convict and remove this president from office. I know the Democrats, certainly the House impeachment managers, have really tried to make the case that, you know, this is setting a precedent, but it doesn't seem like that had any real impact.
No, I mean, really, after we've gone through this entire process, in the end, very few minds have been changed. And actually, Democratic Senator from West Virginia, Joe Manchin, actually came up to the Senate floor yesterday and said that he had was having a difficult time deciding to vote for impeachment and would really prefer to censure the president, which is, quite frankly, a non-starter up here. It's really a choice between removing Trump from office or acquitting him. But it really speaks to the fact that a Democratic senator who is in a state with a lot of Trump supporters is struggling with this decision as well, and is really almost coming down on the side of not voting for Trump's guilt. I think that's very telling and tells you a lot about the political atmosphere in an election year, which, of course, this is the first time that we've had an impeachment happening during an election year. So those considerations are really coming into play up here on Capitol Hill.
What about the fact that Democrats expressed concerns that if the president is not held accountable for asking for political favors from a foreign country in help with his reelection or basically targeting a potential opponent, their concerns they expressed were that if he's not held accountable, he would just do it again, and there might be concerns now about the upcoming presidential election.
Right. I mean, absolutely. House impeachment managers have brought that up here when they've been talking about the vote to remove the president. They're telling Republicans, look, how are you going to really function as an effective check on the executive branch if you are going to vote to acquit him for what they see as the highest abuse of power a president can commit, which is to invite foreign election interference in an upcoming election? And they argue that the push for this impeachment, the urgency in it, the reason why they didn't go to the courts to push through some of those subpoenas is because they had this urgency that they had to address this before the November election. This is something that they've really talked about in their closing arguments. They're saying, look, to Republicans, you need to think about the implications of this in an election year, and you need to think about what you're going to do to him. Otherwise, you have an executive presidency that's really unchecked, and according to Democrats, it's a breakdown of the system that was set up in the U.S. Constitution. It's a huge concern up here.
It's all but inevitable that the president is acquitted, and if so, what happens after that? Are Democrats concerned that this could embolden the president to feel that he has carte blanche to do whatever he feels he needs to do without any ramifications?
That's certainly a concern up here, but if you also listen to one of the lead House impeachment manager, Adam Schiff, he has been playing his cards very closely about what he's going to be doing after this impeachment trial ends. The prospect of subpoenaing John Bolton, the former national security advisor, who of course came out with that blockbuster book over the course of the impeachment trial. There's been some talk that the House could continue an investigation and that that would be one way that they could continue to put pressure on the president and remind him, hey, look, the U.S. Congress is still here and is still investigating you. But of course, you know, in the end, they're not going to go through another impeachment trial. President Trump knows that, and President Trump is also notching the highest approval ratings of his presidency to date, a personal best of 49% approval rate. So the Democrats need to be really careful that they don't overplay their hand, knowing that the November election is coming up. They don't want to turn off those voters who could potentially come out and vote for a Democrat. They don't want to turn them off with this constant push of investigations. So it's a really delicate balancing act the Democrats have ahead of them.
That's VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Well, here are some of the other stories we're following at voanews.com. President's approval ratings, as you just heard, have reached a new high in a Gallup poll. After brutally crushing dissent, the late Kenyan ex-leader leaves a mixed legacy. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo defends dropping a reporter from his trip as the perfect message on press freedom. And Chinese Americans worry about backlash as the coronavirus fears mount. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, the first long-awaited contest for the U.S. Democratic presidential nomination in the farm state of Iowa was mired in chaos Tuesday with preliminary results announced a day after complicated caucus voting ended. The state Democratic Party was unable to report even a single vote count 15 hours after about 100,000 of the party faithful showed up to vote for their favorite candidate. Chairman of Iowa State Democratic Party Troy Price Tuesday apologized for the delayed results, saying it was due to an abundance of precautions to confirm the data.
The bottom line is that we hit a stumbling block on the back end of the reporting of the data. But the one thing I want you to know, we know this data is accurate.
And joining us now from the Midwest, VOA correspondent Kane Farabaugh in Iowa, who has been there through it all. Kane, what have you been seeing and hearing on the ground about all that's transpired and who could potentially have won this state?
Well, really, it boils down to technology. I mean, the Iowa Democratic Party was really hoping to be able to tally the results of these caucus meetings on this newly developed app that they had. And they were hoping to get those results in sooner. It would have been expedient and efficient for them to do so. The problem is, and they admitted this the day after the election, there seems to be a coding problem in the actual app that they were trying to use. And so the technology failed them. And because there was so many precincts trying to report back to Democrat Party headquarters with their results, the phone lines were busy. And so people couldn't get through to give them those results. So Iowa Democrats wanted to make sure they got this right. They wanted to make sure that the integrity of this election was sound. And so they didn't want to report any sort of results until they were absolutely sure they could verify those results by having paper documentation back up what they were seeing coming in on the app as well as from the phone tallies. But all of this is really just a big mess that is a source of embarrassment for Iowa Democrats. And it really throws into question the relevance of the Iowa caucus at this point, since most of the candidates have moved on without knowing what the results are to New Hampshire, and how this is going to be in 4 years to come during the next election cycle.
As far as we know, they finally did get some preliminary results out. What are we hearing?
Well, at least as far as the numbers that the Iowa Democratic Party is putting out there right now, it shows that former South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg is leading in those precincts that have successfully gotten their reporting tallied. It looks like Bernie Sanders is in second place, and then well behind them, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren and former Vice President Joe Biden. It looks right now like he's somewhere around fourth place, which, you know, for a former Vice President of the United States is quite a remarkable distance from first place, which is where the Biden camp had hoped to be coming out of the Iowa caucuses. They spend a lot of money and time in the state hoping to win it.
Well, that could be concerning going forward. I'm sure that may definitely be a stumbling block for him going forward, or who knows. And, of course, it's certainly a surprise to see that the former mayor, Pete Buttigieg, did so well. A long-shot person, just really shooting straight to the top, not really a well-known name.
I think, above all things, he is considered to be a moderate, and he's younger. You know, he's a contrast to many of the other candidates that are on the campaign trail. But he invested himself in Iowa. He spent a tremendous amount of time in Iowa, campaigning, spending money on advertising, you know, hosting events, being involved in many different activities there in the state over the past year and a half. And the question will be now, he has spent so much time in Iowa campaigning and trying to build what would be a now a successful campaign to help him win the Iowa caucuses. He's virtually spent no time in New Hampshire. I mean, he's been there for a few events, but he hasn't spent the amount of time in New Hampshire that he has in Iowa. So will he be successful in New Hampshire like he was in Iowa? It's going to be difficult for him because New Hampshire could be considered to be Senator Bernie Sanders' home turf. Vermont is a state right next door. Also, it's in New England, which is also where Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren is from. Hmm. So it remains to be seen. I guess we'll know in a week what the outcome of that will be. But Pete Buttigieg could have a hard time doing just as well in New Hampshire as he did in Iowa.
Right. No, it'll be interesting to see what happens with former Vice President Joe Biden, if he can sort of come back in some of these upcoming races. Super Tuesday, for sure. There are some states that he seems to be polling pretty well.
Well, the other thing here, too, is we can't forget the name that isn't really mentioned right now, and that is former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg. He is not, has not had a presence, really, in Iowa other than to pay for advertising on television and on social media sites on the Internet. But Michael Bloomberg virtually made no appearances or traveled a lot in Iowa, and so he's not tallied in those results. He is focusing on those Super Tuesday states. And so it'll be interesting to see, once he's a factor in the campaign, how many votes he may take away from former Vice President Joe Biden or perhaps some of the other candidates that are looking for an alternative. But ultimately, I think what everybody's looking for is that candidate who they think can best defeat Donald Trump in November.
All right, VOA correspondent Kane Farabaugh, you're listening to International Edition. We'll be back in just a sec.
Voices. We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, the U.S. and Nigeria have both expressed hope that new visa restrictions announced last week will soon be lifted after Africa's most populous nation was added to a list of countries facing restrictions. Nigeria's foreign minister and secretary of state, Mike Pompeo, met at the State Department Tuesday. Nigeria's foreign minister, Jeffrey Onyema, sought more information on Trump's latest immigration crackdown announced last week, which targeted Nigeria and five other countries.
A lot of people back home in Nigeria understood it and put different interpretations and different spins on it. But it's, you know, it's essentially very straightforward. And it was very gratifying to come here speaking to U.S. officials and to understand more clearly the reasoning behind this.
Pompeo praised Nigeria's efforts to defeat the Islamic State group and its affiliate, Islamic State West Africa.
Nigeria was one of the first African nations to join the global coalition to defeat ISIS. America is now supporting the Nigerian fight against ISIS's larger global affiliate, ISIS West Africa, a dangerous threat to both of our countries.
Pompeo said Nigeria has been looking to address U.S. concerns, including information on suspected terrorists and embedding electronic data into passports. He said the Trump administration hopes these issues will be resolved quickly. Well, it seems almost daily there's another story about Grammy-winning pop singer Billie Eilish, and today is no exception. The 18-year-old who swept the boards at the 62nd Annual Grammy Awards is now going to appear on the cover of American Vogue magazine's March issue. She was previously on the cover of Vogue Australia. No surprise, her style and popularity are catching the eye of the fashion world. She says her choices reflect her love of fashion and hatred of her body, which she has worked to overcome. She has shied away from revealing her struggles with body image, led to her baggy attire. Another issue, she's also not shied away from her concerns for the environment, and it's for that reason, she says, she's making plans for her upcoming world tour, which gets underway in March. Eilish says she's partnering with nonprofit group Reverb to make sure her tour is completely eco-friendly. There will be no plastic straws allowed, and fans will have to bring their own water bottles. She says she wants the tour to be as green as possible. Been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today. But you can always find us at voanews.com, and we always thank you for being with us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Calvin Fowler. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
I tried to scream, but my head was underwater. They called me weak, like I'm not just somebody's daughter. It could have been a nightmare, but it felt like they were right there. And it feels like yesterday was a year ago. But I don't wanna let anybody know, 'cause everybody